but there were no waves at Deepwood Mott, only the trees, the endless trees, soldier pines and sentinels, beech and ash and ancient oaks, chestnut trees and ironwoods and firs. The sound they made was softer than the sea, and she heard it only when the wind was blowing. Then the sighing seemed to come from all around her, as if the trees were whispering to one another in some language she could not understand. Tonight the whispering seemed louder than before. "A rush of dead brown leaves," Asher told herself, "bare branches creaking in the wind." She turned away from the window, away from the woods. "I need a deck beneath my feet again, or, failing that, some food in my belly." She'd had too much wine tonight, and too little bread, and none of that great, bloody roast. The moonlight was bright enough to find her clothes. She donned thick black breeches, a quilted tunic, and a green leather jerkin covered with overlapping plates of steel. Leaving Carl to his dreams, she padded down the keep's exterior stair, the steps creaking under her bare feet. One of the men walking sentry on the walls spied her making her descent and lifted his spear to her. Asher whistled back at him. As she crossed the inner yard to the kitchens, Gorbett Glover's dogs began to bark. "Good," she thought, "that will drown out the sound of the trees." She was cutting a wedge of yellow cheese from a round as big as a cartwheel when Tris Butley stepped into the kitchen, bundled up in a thick fur cloak. "My queen! Don't mock me. You will always rule my heart. No amount of fools shouting at a king's moot can change that." "What am I to do with this boy?" Asher could not doubt his devotion. Not only had he stood her champion on Nagas Hill and shouted out her name, but he had even crossed the sea to join her afterwards, abandoning his king and kin and home. Not that he dared defy Euron to his face. When the Crow's Eye took the fleet to sea, Triss had simply lagged behind, changing course only when the other ships were lost to sight. Even that took a certain courage, though. He could never return to the Isles. "Cheese?" she asked him. "There's ham as well, and mustard." "It's not food I want, my lady. You know that." Triss had grown himself a thick brown beard at Deepwood. He claimed it helped to keep his face warm. I saw you from the watchtower. If you have the watch, what are you doing here? Crumb's up there, and Hagen the Horn. How many eyes do we need to watch leaves rustle in the moonlight? We need to talk. Again? She sighed. You know Hagen's daughter, the one with the red hair. She steers a ship as well as any man, and she has a pretty face. 17, and I've seen her looking at you. I don't want Hagen's daughter. He almost touched her before thinking better of it. Asher, it's time to go. Moat Cailin was the only thing holding back the tide. If we remain here, the Northmen would kill us all. You know that. Would you have me run? I would have you live. I love you. No, she thought. You love some innocent maiden who lives only in your head, a frightened child in need of your protection. I do not love you, she said bluntly. And I do not run. What's here that you should hold so tight to it, but pine and mud and foes? We have our ships. Sail away with me, and we'll make new lives upon the sea. As pirates, it was almost tempting. Let the wolves have back their gloomy woods and retake the open sea. As traders, he insisted, we'll voyage east as the Crow's Eye did, but we'll come back with silks and spices instead of a dragon's horn. One voyage to the Jade Sea, and we'll be as rich as gods. We can have a manse in Old Town, or one of the free cities. You and me, and Carl? She saw him flinch at the mention of Carl's name. Hagen's girl might like to sail the Jade Sea with you. I am still the Kraken's daughter. My place is... Where? You cannot return to the Isles, not unless you mean to submit to your lord husband. Asher tried to picture herself abed with Eric Ironmaker, crushed beneath his bulk, suffering his embraces. Better him than the red oarsman or left-hand Lucas Cod. The anvil-breaker had once been a roaring giant, fearsomely strong, fiercely loyal, utterly without fear. It might not be so bad. He's like today the first time he tries to do his duty as a husband. That would make her Eric's widow instead of Eric's wife, which could be better or a good deal worse, depending on his grandsons. And my nuncle. In the end, all the winds blow me back to Euron. I have hostages on Harlow, she reminded him, and there is still Sea Dragon Point. If I cannot have my father's kingdom, why not make one of my own? Sea Dragon Point had not always been as thinly peopled as it was now. Old ruins could still be found amongst its hills and bogs, the remains of ancient strongholds of the first men. In the high places there were weirwood circles left by the children of the forest. You are clinging to Sea Dragon Point the way a drowning man clings to a bit of wreckage. What does Sea Dragon have that anyone could ever want? There are no mines, no gold, no silver, not even tin or iron. The land is too wet for wheat or corn. I do not plan on planting wheat or corn. What's there? I'll tell you. Two long coastlines, 100 hidden coves, otters in the lakes, salmon in the rivers, clams along the shore, colonies of seals offshore, tall pines for building ships. Who will build these ships, my queen? Where will your grace find subjects for a kingdom if the Northmen let you have it? Or do you mean to rule over a realm of seals and otters? She gave a rueful laugh. Otters might be easier to rule than men, I grant you, and seals are smarter. No, you may be right. My best course may still be to return to Pike. There are those on Harlow who would welcome my return, on Pike as well. And Euron won no friends on Black Tide when he slew Lord Baelor. I could find my uncle Aaron, raise the Isles. No one has seen the damp hair since the King's Moot, but his drowned men claimed he was hiding on Great Wick, and would soon come forth to call down the wrath of the drowned god on the Crow's Eye and his minions. The Anvil Breaker is searching for the damp hair, too. He is hunting down the drowned men. Blind Baron Blacktard was taken and put to the question. Even the old grey gull was given shackles. How will you find the priest when all of Euron's men cannot? He is my blood, my father's brother. It was a feeble answer, and Asher knew it. Do you know what I think? I'm about to, I suspect. I think the damp hair is dead. I think the Crow's Eye slit his throat for him. Ironmaker's search is just to make us believe the priest escaped. Euron is afraid to be seen as a kinslayer. Never let my nuncle hear you say that. Tell the Crow's Eye he's afraid of kinslaying, and he'll murder one of his own sons just to prove you wrong. Asher was feeling almost sober by then. Christopher Butley had that effect on her. Even if you did find your uncle Dampier, the two of you would fail. You were both part of the Kingsmoot, so you cannot say it was unlawful called, as Torgon did. You are bound to its decision by all the laws of gods and men. You, Asher frowned. Wait, Torgon? Which Torgon? Torgon the latecomer? He was a king during the Age of Heroes. She recalled that much about him, but little else. What of him? Torgon Greyarn was a king's eldest son, but the king was old and Torgon restless, so it happened that when his father died he was raiding along the Mander from his stronghold on Greyshield. His brother sent no word to him, but instead quickly called a king's moot, thinking that one of them would be chosen to wear the Driftwood crown. But the captains and the kings chose Euregan, good brother, to rule instead. The first thing the new king did was command that all the sons of the old king be put to death, and so they were. After that, men called him bad brother, though in truth they'd been no kin of his. He ruled for almost 2 years. Asher remembered now. Torgon came home. and said the king's moot was unlawful, since he had not been there to make his claim. Bad Brother had proved to be as mean as he was cruel, and he had few friends left upon the isles. The priests denounced him, the lords rose against him, and his own captains hacked him into pieces. Torgon the Latecomer became the king, and ruled for 40 years. Asher took Triss Butley by the ears and kissed him full upon the lips. He was red and breathless by the time she'd let him go.
"What was that?"
he said. "A kiss, it's called. Oh, drown me for a fool, Triss. I should have remembered." She broke off suddenly. When Triss tried to speak, she shushed him, listening.
"That's a warhorn. Hagen."
Her first thought was of her husband. Could Eric Ironmaker have come all this way to claim his wayward wife? The drone god loves me after all. Here I was wondering what to do, and he has sent me foes to fight. Asher got to her feet and slammed her knife back into its sheath. "The battle's come to us." She was trotting by the time she reached the castle bailey, with Triss dogging her heels. But even so, she came too late. The fight was done. Asher found two Northmen bleeding by the eastern wall, not far from the postern gate, with Loren Longaxe, Six-Toed Harl, and Grimtongue standing over them. "Crum and Egan saw them coming over the wall," Grimtongue explained. "Just these two?" asked Asher. "Five. We killed two before they could get over, and Harl slew another on the wall walk. These two made it to the yard. One man was dead, his blood and brains crusting Loren's Longaxe, but the second was still breathing, raggedly, though Grimtong's spear had pinned him to the ground in a spreading pool of blood. Both were clad in boiled leather and mottled cloaks of brown and green and black, with branches, leaves, and brush sewn about their heads and shoulders.
"Who are you?" Asher asked the wounded man.
"A flint. Who are you?"
"Asher of House Greyjoy. This is my castle."
"Deepwood be Galbert Glover's seat. No home for squids."
"Are there any more of you?" Asher demanded of him.
When he did not answer, she seized Grimtongue's spear and turned it, and the Northman cried out in anguish as more blood gushed from his wound.
"What was your purpose here?"
The lady," he said, shuddering. "God's a stop! We come for the lady, to rescue her. It was just us five."
Asher looked into his eyes. When she saw the falsehood there, she leaned upon the spear, twisting it.
"How many more?" she said. "Tell me, or I'll make your dying last until the dawn."
"Many,"
he finally sobbed between screams.
"Thousands? 3,000? 4? Please, please!"
She ripped the spear out of him and drove it down two-handed through his lying throat. Gorbert Glover's maester had claimed the mountain clans were too quarrelsome to ever band together without a Stark to lead them. He might not have been lying. He might just have been wrong. She had learned what that tasted like at her uncle's King's Moot. "These five were sent to open our gates before the main attack," she said. "Loren, Harl, fetch me Lady Glover and her mister."
"Whole or bloody?" asked Loren Longaxe.
"Whole and unharmed. Grimtongue, get up that thrice-damned tower and tell Crum and Hagen to keep a sharp eye out. If they see so much as a hair, I want to know of it."
Deepwood's bailey was soon full of frightened people. Her own men were struggling into armour or climbing up onto the wall walks. Gorbert Glover's folk looked on with fearful faces, whispering to one another. Glover's steward had to be carried up from the cellar, having lost a leg when Asher took the castle. The maester protested noisily until Loren cracked him hard across the face with a mailed fist. Lady Glover emerged from the godswood on the arm of her bedmaid.
"I warned you that this day would come, my lady," she said, when she saw the corpses on the ground.
The maester pushed forward, with blood dripping from her broken nose.
Lady Asher, I beg you, strike your banners and let me bargain for your life. You have used us fairly, and with honour I will tell them so.
We will exchange you for the children.
Sybil Glover's eyes were red, from tears and sleepless nights.
Gowan is four now. I missed his name day. And my sweet girl, give me back my children, and no harm need come to you, nor to your men.
The last part was a lie, Asher knew. She might be exchanged, perhaps, shipped back to the Aran Islands to her husband's loving arms. Her cousins would be ransomed, too, as would Triss Butley and a few more of her company, those whose kin had coin enough to buy them back. For the rest, it would be the axe, the noose, or the wall. Still, they have the right to choose. Asher climbed on a barrel so all of them could see her.
The wolves are coming down on us with their teeth bared. They will be at our gates before the sun comes up. Shall we throw down our spears and axes and plead with them to spare us?
No, Carl the Maid drew his sword. No, echoed Loren Longaxe. No, boomed Rolf the Dwarf, a bear of a man who stood a head taller than anyone else in her crew.
Never!
And Hagen's horn sounded again from on high, ringing out across the bailey.
Oh!
The warhorn cried, long and low, a sound to curdle blood. Asher had begun to hate the sound of horns. On Olwick, her uncle's hellhorn had blown a death knell for her dreams, and now Hagen was sounding what might well be her last hour on earth. If I must die, I will die with an axe in my hand and a curse upon my lips. To the walls, Asher Greyjoy told her men. She turned her own steps for the watchtower, with Triss Butley right behind her. The wooden watchtower was the tallest thing this side of the mountains, rising 20 feet above the biggest sentinels and soldier pines in the surrounding woods.
There, Captain, said Crumb,
when she made the platform. Asher saw only trees and shadows, the moonlit hills and the snowy peaks beyond. Then she realized that the trees were creeping closer.
Ho-ho! She laughed. These mountain goats have cloaked themselves in pine boughs.
The woods were on the move, creeping toward the castle like a slow green tide. She thought back to a tale she'd heard as a child about the children of the forest and their battles with the first men, when the green seers turned the trees to warriors.
We cannot fight so many, Triss Butley said.
We can fight as many as come, Pop, insisted Crump. The more they are, the more the glory. Men will sing of us.
Aye, but will they sing of your courage or my folly?
The sea was 5 long leagues away. Would they do better to stand and fight behind deep woods, deep ditches, and wooden walls?
Deep woods, wooden walls, did the Glover small good when I took their castle, she reminded herself. Why should they serve me any better?
Come the morrow, we will feast beneath the sea. Crumb stroked his axe, as if he could not wait.
Hagen lowered his horn.
If we die with dry feet, how will we find our way to the drowned god's watery halls?
These woods are full of little streams, Crumb assured him. All of them lead to rivers, and all the rivers to the sea.
Asher was not ready to die. Not here, not yet. A living man can find the sea more easily than a dead one. Let the wolves keep their gloomy woods. We're making for the ships. She wondered who was in command of her foes. If it were me, I would take the strand and put our longships to the torch before attacking Deepwood. The wolves would not find that easy, though, not without longships of their own. Asher never beached more than half her ships. The other half stood safely off to sea, with orders to raise sail and make for Sea Dragon Point if the Northmen took the strand.
Hagen blew your horn and make the forest shake. Triss done some mail. It's time you tried out that sweet sword of yours.
When she saw how pale he was, she pinched his cheek.
splash some blood upon the moon with me, and I promise you a kiss for every kill.
My queen, said Christopher, here we have the walls, but if we reach the sea and find that the walls have taken our ships or driven them away, we die, she finished cheerfully, but at least we'll die with our feet wet. Ironborn fight better with salt spray in their nostrils and the sound of the waves at their backs. Hagen blew three short blasts in quick succession, the signal that would send the Ironborn to their ships. From down below came shouting, the clatter of spear and sword, the whinnying of horses. Too few horses and too few riders. Asher headed for the stair. In the bailey she found Carl, the maid, waiting with her chestnut mare, her war helm, and her throwing axes. Iron men were leading horses from Gorbert Glover's stables.
A ram! A voice shouted down from the walls. They have a battering ram!
Which gate? Asked Asher, mounting up.
The north!
From beyond Deepwood's mossy wooden walls came the sudden sound of trumpets.
Trumpets? Walls with trumpets?
That was wrong, but Asher had no time to ponder it.
Open the south gate!
She commanded, even as the north gate shook to the impact of the ram. She pulled a short hafted throwing axe from the belt across her shoulder.
The hour of the owl has fled, my brothers. Now comes the hour of the spear, the sword, the axe. Form up! We're going home!
From 100 throats came roars of home and Asher! Triss Butley galloped up beside her on a tall roan stallion. In the bailey, her men closed about each other, hefting shields and spears. Carl, the maid, no horse rider, took his place between Grimtongue and Lauren Longaxe. As Hagen came scrambling down the watchtower steps, a wolfling's arrow caught him in the belly and sent him plunging headfirst to the ground. His daughter ran to him, wailing.
"Bring her," Asher commanded.
This was no time for mourning. Rolf the dwarf pulled the girl onto his horse, her red hair flying. Asher could hear the north gate groaning as a ram slammed into it again. "We may need to cut our way through them," she thought, as the south gate swung wide before them. The way was clear. For how long?
"Move out!"
Asher drove her heels into a horse's flanks. Men and mounts alike were trotting by the time they reached the trees, on the far side of the sudden field where dead shoots of winter wheat rotted beneath the moon. Asher held her horsemen back as a rear guard to keep the stragglers moving and see that no one was left behind. Tall soldier pines and gnarled old oaks closed in around them. Deepwood was aptly named. The trees were huge and dark, somehow threatening. Their limbs weaved through one another and creaked with every breath of wind, and their higher branches scratched at the face of the moon.
"The sooner we are shut up here, the better I will like it," Asher thought. "The trees hate us all, deep in their wooden hearts."
They pressed on south and southwest until the wooden towers of Deepwood Mott were lost to sight, and the sounds of trumpets had been swallowed by the woods.
"The wolves have their castle back," she thought. "Perhaps they will be content to let us go."
Triss Butley trotted up beside her.
"We're going the wrong way," he said,
gesturing at the moon as it peered down through the canopy of branches.
"We need to turn north for the ships."
"West first," Asher insisted. "West until the sun comes up, then north." She turned to Rolf the dwarf and Rogan Rossbeard, her best riders. "Scout ahead and make sure our way is clear. I want no surprises when we reach the shore. If you come on wolves, ride back to me with word."
"If we must," promised Rogan, through his huge red beard.
After the scouts had vanished into the trees, the rest of the Ironborn resumed their march, but the going was slow. The trees hid the moon and stars from them, and the forest floor beneath their feet was black and treacherous. Before they had gone half a mile, her cousin Quentin's mare stumbled into a pit and shattered her foreleg. Quentin had to slit her throat to stop her screaming.
"We should make torches," urged Triss.
"Fire will bring the Northmen down on us." Asher cursed beneath her breath, wondering if it had been a mistake to leave the castle.
"No, if we had stayed and fought, we might all be dead by now."
But it was no good blundering on through the dark, either.
"These trees will kill us if they can."
She took off her helm and pushed back her sweat-soaked hair. "The sun will be up in a few hours. We'll stop here and rest till break of day." Stopping proved simple. Rest came hard. No one slept, not even Droop-Eyed Dale, an oarsman who had been known to nap between strokes. Some of the men shared a skin of Gorbert Glover's apple wine, passing it from hand to hand. Those who had brought food shared it with those who had not. The riders fed and watered their horses. Her cousin, Quentin Greyjoy, sent three men up trees to watch for any sign of torches in the woods. Crumb honed his axe and Carl the maid his sword. The horses cropped dead brown grass and weeds. Hagen's red-haired daughter seized Triss Butley by the hand to draw him off into the trees. When he refused her, she went off with six-toed Harl instead.
"Would that I could do the same.
It would be sweet to lose herself in Carl's arms one last time." Asher had a bad feeling in her belly. Would she ever feel Black Wind's deck beneath her feet again? And if she did, where would she sail her? "The isles are closed to me, unless I mean to bend my knees and spread my legs and suffer Eric Ironmaker's embraces. And no port in Westeros is like to welcome the Kraken's daughter. She could turn merchanter, as Triss seemed to want, or else make for the Stepstones and join the pirates there, or—"
"I send you each a piece of prince," she muttered. Carl grinned.
"I would sooner have a piece of you," he whispered. "The sweet piece that's—" Something flew from the brush to land with a soft thump in their midst, bumping and bouncing. It was round and dark and wet, with long hair that whipped about it as it rolled. When it came to rest amongst the roots of an oak, Grimtongue said,
"Rolf the Dwarf's not so tall as he once was."
Half her men were on their feet by then, reaching for shields and spears and axes. "They lit no torches either," Asher had time enough to think, "and they know these woods better than we ever could." Then the trees erupted all around them, and the Northmen poured in, howling. "Wolves," she thought, "they howl like bloody wolves, the war cry of the North." Her Ironborn screamed back at them, and the fight began. No singer would ever make a song about that battle. No maester would ever write down an account for one of the reader's beloved books. No banners flew, no war horns moaned, no great lord called his men about him to hear his final ringing words. They fought in the pre-dawn gloom, shadow against shadow, stumbling over roots and rocks, with mud and rotting leaves beneath their feet. The Ironborn were clad in mail and salt-stained leather, the Northmen in furs and hides and piney branches. The moon and stars looked down upon their struggle. Their pale light filtered through the tangle of bare limbs that twisted overhead. The first man to come at Asher Greyjoy died at her feet with her throwing axe between his eyes. That gave her respite enough to slip her shield onto her arm. "To me!" she called. But whether she was calling to her own men or the foes, even Asher could not have said for certain. A Northman with an axe loomed up before her, swinging with both hands as he howled in wordless fury. Asher raised her shield to block his blow, then shoved in close to gut him with her dirk. His howling took on a different tone as he fell. She spun and found another wolf behind her, and slashed him across the brow beneath his helm. His own cut caught her below the breast, but her mail turned it. So she drove the point of her dirk into his throat, and left him to drown in his own blood. A hand seized her hair, but short as it was, he could not get a good enough grip to wrench her head back. Asher slammed her boot heel down into his instep, and wrenched loose when he cried out in pain. By the time she turned, the man was down and dying, still clutching a handful of her hair. Carl stood over him, with his longsword dripping and moonlight shining in his eyes. Grimtong was counting the Northmen as he killed them, calling out, 4, as one went down, 5, a heartbeat later. The horses screamed and kicked and rolled their eyes in terror, maddened by the butchery and blood. All but Triss Butler's big roan stallion. Triss had gained the saddle, and his mount was rearing and wheeling as he laid about with his sword. "I may owe him a kiss or three before the night is done," thought Asher. 7, shouted Grimtong, but beside him Lauren Longaxe sprawled with one leg twisted under him, and the shadows kept on coming, shouting and rustling. "We are fighting shrubbery," Asher thought, as she slew a man who had more leaves on him than most of the surrounding trees. That made her laugh. Her laughter drew more wolves to her, and she killed them too, wondering if she should start a count of her own. "I am a woman wed, and here's my suckling babe." She pushed her dirk into a Northman's chest, through fur and wool and boiled leather. His face was so close to hers that she could smell the sour stench of his breath, and his hand was at her throat. Asher felt iron scraping against bone as her point slid over a rib. Then the man shuddered and died. When she let go of him, she was so weak she almost fell on top of him. Later she stood back to back with Carl, listening to the grunts and curses all around them, to brave men crawling through the shadows, weeping for their mothers. A bush drove at her with a spear long enough to punch through her belly and Carl's back as well, pinning them together as they died. Better that than die alone, she thought. But her cousin Quentin killed the spearman before he reached her. A heartbeat later, another bush killed Quentin, driving an axe into the base of his skull. Behind her, Grimtong shouted, 9, and damn you all! Hagen's daughter burst naked from beneath the trees, with 2 wolves at her heels. Asher wrenched loose a throwing axe and sent it flying end over end to take one of them in the back. When he fell, Hagen's daughter stumbled to her knees, snatched up his sword, stabbed the second man, then rose again, smeared with blood and mud, her long red hair unbound, and plunged into the fight. Somewhere in the ebb and flow of battle, Asher lost Carl, lost Triss, lost all of them. Her dirk was gone as well, and all her throwing axes. Instead, she had a sword in hand, a short sword with a broad, thick blade, almost like a butcher's cleaver. For her life, she could not have said where she had gotten it. Her arm ached, her mouth tasted of blood, her legs were trembling, and shafts of pale dawn light were slanting through the trees. "Has it been so long? How long have we been fighting?" Her last foe was a Northman with an axe, a big man bald and bearded, clad in a burnie of patched and rusted mail that could only mean he was a chief or champion. He was not pleased to find himself fighting a woman. "Cunt!" he roared each time he struck at her, his spittle dampening her cheeks. "Cunt! Cunt!" Asher wanted to shout back at him, but her throat was so dry she could do no more than grunt. His axe was shivering her shield, cracking the wood on the downswing, tearing off long, pale splinters when he wrenched it back. Soon she would have only a tangle of kindling on her arm. She backed away and shook free of the ruined shield, then backed away some more and danced left and right and left again to avoid the down-rushing axe. and then her back came up hard against a tree, and she could dance no more. The wolf raised the axe above his head to split her head in two. Asher tried to slip to her right, but her feet were tangled in some roots, trapping her. She twisted, lost her footing, and the axe head crunched against her temple with a scream of steel on steel. The world went red and black and red again. Pain crackled up her leg like lightning, and far away she heard her Northman say, "You bloody cunt!" as he lifted up his axe for the blow that would finish her. A trumpet blew. "That's wrong," she thought. "There are no trumpets in the drowned guard's watery halls. Below the waves, the Merlings hail their lord by blowing into seashells." She dreamed of red hearts burning, and a black stag in a golden wood with flame streaming from his antlers.
Tyrion. By the time they reached Volantis, the sky was purple to the west and black to the east, and the stars were coming out. "The same stars as in Westeros," Tyrion Lannister reflected. He might have taken some comfort in that if he had not been trussed up like a goose and lashed to a saddle. He had given up squirming. The knots that bound him were too tight. Instead, he'd gone as limp as a sack of meal. "Saving my strength," he told himself, though for what he could not have said. Volantis closed its gates at dark, and the guardsmen on the northern gate were grumbling impatiently at the stragglers. They joined the queue behind a wagon laden with limes and oranges. The guards motioned the wagon through with their torches, but took a harder look at the big Andal on his war horse, with his long sword in his mail. A captain was summoned. Whilst he and the knight exchanged some words in Volantine, one of the guardsmen pulled off his clawed gauntlet and gave Tyrion's head a rub. "I'm full of good fortune," the dwarf told him. "Cut me loose, friend, and I'll see you're well rewarded." His captor overheard. "Save your lies for those who speak your tongue, imp," he said when the Volantines waved them on. Then they were moving again, through the gate and beneath the city's massive walls. "You speak my tongue? Can I sway you with promises, or are you determined to buy a lordship with my head?"
"I was a lord, by right of birth. I want no hollow titles. That's all you're likely to get from my sweet sister. And here I've heard a Lannister always pays his debts."
"Oh, every penny, but never a groat more, my lord. You'll get the meal you bargained for, but it won't be sourced with gratitude, and in the end it will not nourish you."
"Might be all I want is to see you pay for crimes. The king's there is accursed in the eyes of gods and men."
"The gods are blind, and men only see what they wish."
"I see you plain enough, imp."
Something dark had crept into the knight's tone.
"I've done things I'm not proud of, things that brought shame unto my house and my father's name. But to kill your own sire, how could any man do that?"
"Give me a crossbow and pull down your breeches, and I'll show you, gladly."
"You think this is a jape?"
I think life is a jape. Yours, mine, everyone's."
Inside the city walls, they rode past guild halls, markets, and bathhouses. Fountains splashed and sang in the centers of wide squares where men sat at stone tables, moving syvas pieces and sipping wine from glass flutes, as slaves lit ornate lanterns to hold the dark at bay. Palms and cedars grew along the cobbled road, and monuments stood at every junction. Many of the statues lacked heads, the dwarf noted, yet even headless they still managed to look imposing in the purple dusk. As the warhorse plodded south along the river, the shops grew smaller and meaner. The trees along the street became a row of stumps. Cobblestones gave way to devil grass beneath their horses' hooves, then to soft, wet mud, the color of baby's night soil. the little bridges that spanned the small streams that fed the Roin creaked alarmingly beneath their weight. Where a fort had once overlooked the river stood a broken gate, gaping open like an old man's toothless mouth. Goats could be glimpsed, peering over the parapets.
"Old Valentus, first daughter of Valeria," the dwarf mused. "Proud Valentus, queen of the Roin and mistress of the summer sea, home to noble lords and lovely ladies of the most ancient blood.
Never mind the packs of naked children that roam the alleys screaming in shrill voices, or the bravos standing at the doors of wine shops, fingering their sword hilts, or the slaves with their bent backs and tattooed faces who scurried everywhere like cockroaches.
Mighty Valentus, grandest and most populous of the 9 free cities.
Ancient wars had depopulated much of the city, however, and large areas of Valentus had begun to sink back into the mud on which it stood.
Beautiful Valentus, city of fountains and flowers. But half the fountains were dry, half the pools cracked and stagnant. Flowering vines sent up creepers from every crack in wall or pavement, and young trees had taken root in the walls of abandoned shops and roofless temples. And then there was the smell. It hung in the hot, humid air, rich, rank, pervasive.
There's fish in it, and flowers, and some elephant dung as well. Something sweet, and something earthy, and something dead and rotten.
This city smells like an old whore, Tyrion announced, like some sagging slattern who has drenched her privy parts in perfume to drown the stench between her legs. Not that I am complaining. With whores, the young ones smell much better, but the old ones no more tricks.
You would know more of that than I do.
Oh, of course, that brothel where we met. Did you take it for a sept? Was that your virgin sister squirming in your lap?
That made him scowl. Give that tongue of yours a rest, unless you'd rather I tied it in a knot.
Tyrion swallowed his retort. His lip was still fat and swollen from the last time he had pushed the big knight too far.
Hard hands and no sense of humour makes for a bad marriage.
That much he'd learned on the road from Selhoris. His thoughts went to his boot, to the mushrooms in his toe. His captor had not searched him quite as thoroughly as he might have.
There is always that escape. Cersei will not have me alive, at least.
Farther south, signs of prosperity began to reappear. Abandoned buildings were seen less often. The naked children vanished. The bravos and the doorways seemed more sumptuously dressed. A few of the inns they passed actually looked like places where a man might sleep, without fear of having his throat slit. Lanterns swung from iron stanchions along the river road, swaying when the wind blew. The streets grew broader, the buildings more imposing. Some were topped with great domes of coloured glass. In the gathering dusk, with fires lit beneath them, the domes glowed blue and red and green and purple. Even so, there was something in the air that made Tyrion uneasy. West of the Roin, he knew, the wharfs of Valentus teemed with sailors, slaves, and traders, and the wine shops, inns, and brothels all catered to them. East of the river, strangers from across the seas were seen less seldom.
"We are not wanted here," the dwarf realized.
The first time they passed an elephant, Tyrion could not help but stare. There had been an elephant in the menagerie at Lannisport when he had been a boy, but she had died when he was 7, and this great grey behemoth looked to be twice her size. Farther on they fell in behind a smaller elephant, white as old bone, and pulling an ornate cart.
"Is an ox cart without an ox?" Tyrion asked his captor.
When that sally got no response, he lapsed back into silence, contemplating the rolling rump of the white dwarf elephant ahead of them. Valentus was overrun with white dwarf elephants. As they drew closer to the black wall and the crowded districts near the long bridge, they saw a dozen of them. Big grey elephants were not uncommon either. Huge beasts with castles on their backs. And in the half-light of evening, the dung carts had come out, attended by half-naked slaves, whose task it was to shovel up the steaming piles left by elephants both great and small. Swarms of flies followed their carts, so the dung slaves had flies tattooed upon their cheeks, to mark them for what they were. "There's a trade for my sweet sister," Tyrion mused. "She'd look so pretty with the little shovel and flies tattooed on those sweet pink cheeks." By then they had slowed to a crawl. The river road was thick with traffic, almost all of it flowing south. The night went with it, a log caught in a current. Tyrion eyed the passing throngs. 9 men of every 10 bore slave marks on their cheeks. So many slaves. Where are they all going? The Red Priests light their night fires at sunset. The High Priest will be speaking. I would avoid it if I could, but to reach the Long Bridge we must pass the Red Temple. 3 blocks later, the street opened up before them, onto a huge torch-lit plaza, and there it stood. 7 save me. That's got to be 3 times the size of the great Sept of Baelor. An enormity of pillars, steps, buttresses, bridges, domes, and towers, flowing into one another as if they had all been chiseled from one colossal rock. The Temple of the Lord of Light loomed like Aegon's High Hill. 100 hues of red, yellow, gold, and orange met and melded into temple walls, dissolving one into the other like clouds at sunset. Its slender towers twisted ever upwards, frozen flames dancing as they reached for the sky. Fire turned to stone. Huge night fires burned beside the temple steps, and between them the High Priest had begun to speak. Benero! The priest stood atop a red stone pillar, joined by a slender stone bridge to a lofty terrace where the lesser priests and acolytes stood. The acolytes were clad in robes of pale yellow and bright orange, priests and priestesses in red. The great plaza before them was packed almost solid. Many and more of the worshippers were wearing some scrap of red cloth, pinned to their sleeves or tied around their brows. Every eye was on the High Priest, save theirs. "Make way," the knight growled, as his horse pushed through the throng. "Clear a path." The volunteers gave way resentfully, with mutters and angry looks. Benero's high voice carried well. Tall and thin, he had a drawn face and skin as white as milk. Flames had been tattooed across his cheeks and chin and shaven head to make a bright red mask that crackled about his eyes and coiled down and around his lipless mouth. "Is that a sleeve tattoo?" asked Tyrion. The knight nodded. "The Red Temple buys them as children and makes them priests or temple prostitutes or warriors. Look there." He pointed at the steps, where a line of men in ornate armor and orange cloaks stood before the temple's doors, clasping spears with points like writhing flames. "The Fiery Hand, the Lord of Light's sacred soldiers, defenders of the temple." "Fire Knights! And how many fingers does this hand have, pray?"
1,000, never more, never less. A new flame is kindled for everyone that gutters out."
Benero jabbed a finger at the moon, made a fist, spread his hands wide. When his voice rose up in a crescendo, flames leapt from his fingers with a sudden whoosh and made the crowd gasp. The priest could trace fiery letters in the air as well. "Valerian glyphs?" Tyrion recognized perhaps 2 in 10. One was doom, the other darkness. Shouts erupted from the crowd. Women were weeping, and men were shaking their fists. "I have a bad feeling about this." The dwarf was reminded of the day Marcella sailed for Dawn, and the riot that boiled up as they made their way back to the Red Keep. Holden Halfmaester had spoken of using the Red Priest to young Griff's advantage, Tyrion recalled. Now that he had seen and heard the man himself, that struck him as a very bad idea. He hoped that Griff had better sense.
Some allies are more dangerous than enemies, but Lord Cunnington will need to puzzle that one out for himself. I am like to be a head on a spike.
The priest was pointing at the black wall behind the temple, gesturing up at its parapets where a handful of armored guardsmen stood gazing down.
What is he saying? Tyrion asked the knight.
The Daenerys stands in peril. The Dark Eye has fallen upon her, and the minions of night are plotting her destruction, praying to their false gods in temples of deceit, conspiring at betrayal with godless outlanders.
The hairs on the back of Tyrion's neck began to prickle.
Prince Aegon will find no friend here.
The Red Priest spoke of ancient prophecy, a prophecy that foretold the coming of a hero to deliver the world from darkness.
One hero, not two. Daenerys has dragons. Aegon does not.
The dwarf did not need to be a prophet himself to foresee how Benero and his followers might react to a second Targaryen.
Griff will see that too, surely, he thought, surprised to find how much he cared.
The knight had forced their way through most of the press at the back of the plaza, ignoring the curses that were flung at them as they passed. One man stepped in front of them, but his captor gripped the hilt of his longsword and drew it just far enough to show a foot of naked steel. The man melted away, and all at once an alley opened up before them. The knight urged his mount to a trot, and they left the crowd behind them. For a while Tyrion could still hear Benero's voice, growing fainter at their back, and the roars his words provoked, sudden as thunder. They came upon a stable. The knight dismounted, then hammered on the door until a haggard slave, with a horse head on his cheek, came running. The dwarf was pulled down roughly from the saddle and lashed to a post, whilst his captor woke the stable's owner and haggled with him over the price of his horse and saddle.
"Cheaper to sell a horse than to ship one half across the world." Tyrion sensed a ship in his immediate future. Perhaps he was a prophet after all.
When the dickering was done, the knight slung his weapon, shield, and saddlebag over his shoulder and asked for directions to the nearest smithy. That proved shuttered too, but opened quick enough at the knight's shout. The smith gave Tyrion a squint, then nodded and accepted a fistful of coins.
"Come here," the knight told his prisoner.
He drew his dagger and slit Tyrion's bonds apart.
"My thanks," said Tyrion as he rubbed his wrists.
But the knight only laughed and said, "Save your gratitude for someone who deserves it, imp. You will not like this next bit." He was not wrong. The manacles were black iron, thick and heavy, each weighing a good 2 pounds if the dwarf was any judge. The chains added even more weight.
"I must be more fearsome than I knew," Tyrion confessed,
as the last links were hammered closed. Each blow sent a shock up his arm, almost to the shoulder.
"Or were you afraid that I would dash away on these stinted little legs of mine?"
The ironsmith did not so much as look up from his work, but the knight chuckled darkly.
"It's your mouth that concerns me, not your legs. In fetters you're a slave. No one will listen to a word you say, not even those who speak the tongue of Westeros."
"There is no need for this," Tyrion protested. "I will be a good little prisoner. I will, I will."
"Prove it, then, and shut your mouth."
So he bowed his head and bit his tongue as the chains were fixed, wrist to wrist, wrist to ankle, ankle to ankle. "These bloody things weigh more than I do." Still, at least, he drew breath. His captor could just as easily have cut his head off. That was all Cersei required, after all. not striking it off straight away, had been his captor's first mistake.
"There is half a world between Volantis and King's Landing, and much and more can happen along the way, sir."
The rest of the way they went by foot, Tyrion clanking and clattering as he struggled to keep up with his captor's long, impatient strides. Whenever he threatened to fall behind, the knight would seize his fetters and yank them roughly, sending the dwarf stumbling and hopping along beside him. "It could be worse. He could be urging me along with a whip." Volantis straddled one mouth of the Roin, where the river kissed the sea, its two halves joined by the long bridge. The oldest, richest part of the city was east of the river, but sellswords, barbarians, and other uncouth outlanders were not welcome there, so they must needs cross over to the west. The gateway to the long bridge was a black stone arch, carved with sphinxes, manticores, dragons, and creatures stranger still. Beyond the arch stretched the great span that the Valyrians had built at the height of their glory, its few stone roadway supported by massive piers. The road was just wide enough for two carts to pass abreast, so whenever a wagon headed west passed one going east, both had to slow to a crawl. It was well they were afoot. A third of the way out, a wagon laden with melons had gotten its wheels tangled with one piled high with silken carpets, and brought all wheeled traffic to a halt. Much of the foot traffic had stopped as well, to watch the drivers curse and scream at one another, but the knight grabbed hold of Tyrion's chain and bulled a path through the throng for both of them. In the middle of the press, a boy tried to reach into his purse, but a hard elbow put an end to that and spread the thief's bloody nose across half his face. Buildings rose to either side of them, shops and temples, taverns and inns, sivas, parlours and brothels. Most were three or four stories tall, each floor overhanging the one beneath it. Their top floors almost kissed. Crossing the bridge felt like passing through a torch-lit tunnel. Along the span were shops and stalls of every sort. Weavers and lace-makers displayed their wares, cheek by jowl with glassblowers, candle-makers, and fishwives selling eels and oysters. Each goldsmith had a guard at his door, and every spicer had two, for their goods were twice as valuable. Here and there, between the shops, a traveller might catch a glimpse of the river he was crossing. To the north, the Roin was a broad black ribbon bright with stars, five times as wide as the Blackwater Rush at King's Landing. South of the bridge, the river opened up to embrace the briny sea. At the bridge's center span, the severed hands of thieves and cutpurses hung like strings of onions from iron stanchions along the roadway. Three heads were on display as well, two men and a woman, their crimes scrawled on tablets underneath them. A pair of spearmen attended them, clad in polished helms and shirts of silver mail. Across their cheeks were tiger stripes as green as jade. From time to time the guards waved their spears to chase away the kestrels, gulls, and carrion crows paying court to the deceased. The birds returned to the heads within moments. "What did they do?" Tyrion inquired innocently. The knight glanced at the inscriptions. "The woman was a slave who raised her hand to her mistress. The older man was accused of fomenting rebellion and spying for the Dragon Queen. And the young one?" "Killed his father." Tyrion gave the rotting head a second look. "Why, it almost looks as if those lips are smiling." Farther on, the knight paused briefly to consider a jeweled tiara displayed upon a bed of purple velvet. He passed that by, but a few steps on, he stopped again to haggle over a pair of gloves at a leather worker's stall. Tyrion was grateful for the respites. The headlong pace had left him puffing, and his wrists were chafed raw from the manacles. from the far end of the long bridge. It was only a short walk through the teeming waterfront districts of the West Bank.